Welcome, everybody, to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this teleseminar series to advance the public dialogue that's taking place at what I think is the leading edge of consciousness and culture, by asking one critical question from many perspectives. How can the growth of human consciousness, the deepening, the expansion of consciousness, enable human beings to truly change our cultural pattern so that we can positively respond to the global crisis that is affecting us all and all creatures and effectively address the state of our world? So this broadcast today is a part of a whole series of conversations on this topic that I've had with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, and which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. Today, I'm really delighted to be joined by Bill Plotkin, and we're going to continue this conversation. We've titled today's conversation, Beyond Apocalypse versus Utopia, the Sole Opportunity of Our Time. So in a second, I'll introduce Bill, and he and I will spend about an hour in dialogue, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend the last half hour or so taking your questions. So I expect we'll finish up in about an hour and a half. Bill Plotkin is a depth psychologist, a wilderness guide, and an author. And most especially, he's a powerful and inspiring voice for the soul of natural places and creatures and for the parts of the human soul that are interwoven with the soul of the natural world. He has deep experience in guiding people through the underworld descent into the soul as a process that flowers into a life of meaningful service and fulfillment, or a deepening for those already on that journey. And he's written three very substantial books. The first was Soulcraft, Crossing into the Mysteries of Nature and Psyche. And it's a compelling experiential guidebook to soul work. It rapidly became a central resource for people serious about the process of engaging with nature and soul-based deepening. His second book, Nature and the Human Soul, Cultivating Wholeness and Community in a Fragmented World, is a richly detailed nature-based stage model of human development through the whole human lifespan. And his most recent book, Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche, offers an ecocentric map of the psyche for healing, growing whole, and cultural transformation. Bill has a doctorate in psychology from the University of Colorado at Boulder, after which he had a career as a research psychologist studying non-ordinary states of consciousness, a professor of psychology, and a psychotherapist. In 1979, on a solo winter ascent in the Adirondacks, Bill experienced a call to adventure, leading him to abandon academia in search of his true calling. And since then, after founding Western Colorado's Animas Valley Institute in 1981, he's guided thousands of women and men through nature-based initiatory passages, including a contemporary Western adaptation of the pan-cultural vision quest. What I especially appreciate about Bill is certainly his depth of feeling and intelligence and empathy and awakeness, his wild soul, but especially that even though he's seen and felt and known and experienced so much, and even though he's deeply embodied his soul purpose in a powerful way that is serving thousands of others, he's not unwilling to cast aside all that apparent confirmation of everything he seems to know and rest in what is sometimes called don't know mind. He's inclined, as I am, to stand humble and astonished in the presence of the mystery, the many faces of the greater than human and greater than mind mystery. So it has been in this spirit that we have been able to come together with deep and sincere mutual respect and a genuinely co-creative spirit, even though we come from very different original traditions of work. So welcome, Bill. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, thank you, Terry. It's great to be in conversation with you this morning, and I appreciate your introduction. Very nice. Thank you.
Well, great. Now, I know you've recently returned after some time in wilderness, and the last time we talked was before this recent trip. Is there anything that you've taken from this recent time in wildness and in silence that you'd like to say before we begin our conversation today?
Well, let's see. I don't know if anything new in terms of categories of experience, but it was a great honor and pleasure to be with a group in the Southern California desert, a group in a year-long process of soul initiation. We went to the Southern California desert where there was been drought for 4 or 5 months, and by our fourth day there we got some rain, and the fragrance that came through came out of the desert was just quite stunning. And then my partner Janine Haugen and I had a week at Esalen guiding a program we designed for Esalen called Romancing the World, which we just love guiding that program and being at Esalen and being with the astonishing springtime there that of the sort we don't see here in Colorado, and where everything is blooming and unfamiliar species and the whales spouting and the dolphins and the otters and the condors and so on. And the other thing that's happened since we talked last is the muse woke me up at about 3 a.m. This morning and gave me a major download, which I'm still kind of reeling from. But I'm sure it'll all get woven in to our conversation today.
Well, terrific. What is emergent is always what's most alive. So I'm delighted to hear that. Thank you. Well, when we chatted earlier about what we wanted to discuss today, we decided that what might be most potent would be to drive right into the most powerful set of questions that we have also put out in our announcements of this conversation today to our networks. And you know, some of those questions were, is our current planetary crisis leading only to disaster? Has humanity gone terribly wrong? Or might this be a late phase of an evolutionary opportunity whose outcome is as yet entirely uncertain? Is our crisis right now precisely the sort to be expected on any planet in which a species evolves into conscious self-awareness? And I want to just invite you to speak to those big questions right here at the outset.
Wow. That's quite a challenge, and we'll see what we can do. One of the questions you left out was that we had talked about was what is emerging today at the leading edge of human transformation. And I think what I need to do is the best thing to do is to give our listeners a little background about the work we've been doing at Animas Valley Institute to set this into context, because one of the things I've been doing the last 30 years is, which it wasn't in my bio, in fact I haven't thought of putting it in my bio, is I'm a map maker or a model designer. I've been developing ways to talk about human development that I hadn't found elsewhere in the Western traditions that helped me get oriented about who we are as human beings and where we're going and where we've been, for that matter, and who we are, and where we might get to, and so on. And these are the kind of questions you and I want to address anyways.
Yeah.
So one map that I want to mention, and because we find it in cultures all over the world, although it's interpreted different ways, and I think it's just this simple three-part map is just central to, I think, what at least the part that I would like to talk about this morning, is I call it the Three Worlds Map. And this idea that, and we find this again in cultures all over the world, including Western traditions, that life, existence, the world is divided into these three zones that we could call the upper world, the middle world and the underworld. And these are very three different realms. And I want to bring it up at the outset here because the contemporary Western mainstream world or culture basically just understands life as what I'll explain in a moment is as the middle world, and contemporary Western spiritualities, including what have been adopted from the Eastern lands, really only address the upper world. But there's this underworld part that has been pretty much left out, which for me has everything to do with soul. And I think that has everything to do with our big opportunities at this time. So briefly, the middle world is that realm of life that has to do with everyday life, of growing food, gathering food, taking care of our families, creating organizations and institutions, educating kids, raising children more generally, keeping the village in a good way, and being in respectful relationship with the land and the waters and the air. It's our what we would just say is our everyday life. It's our, let's say it's our personal and interpersonal life. And a lot of people in the Western world today would say, well, that's everything, isn't it? It isn't from the perspective of many cultures and spiritually oriented people around the world. There's these two other realms. And the upper world is a way to refer to the realm of spirit or God or the divine, or we might refer to it as the one or the non-dual. And it's the realm of experience where if we cultivate our lives in that way, we might come to experience our own consciousness as a strand in this greater, more vast consciousness or vast imagination, which in some sense is the cosmos itself. And so this is when we move from our middle world life to the realm, the non-dual realm, we're in a sense, at least metaphorically, we're moving upward. So that's often called the upper world. And that's my, I've come to understand that the upper world experience is half of spirituality or half of the transpersonal. And the other half is pretty much left out in the Western tradition, with some exceptions mostly found in the depth psychology world. So the underworld is where we move from the middle world downward into the, not the sacred light, but the sacred dark, the fruitful darkness, and towards what is most unique about us, and actually in a, you could say in a soulful way or in an ecological way, which are two ways of really saying the same thing, because our soul is essentially a part of the natural world or a particular place in the natural world or a niche in the natural world. And our soul, what I mean by soul is, because I don't mean the same thing many other people mean, so the definition is kind of important here. What I mean by soul is essentially our unique place or role that we were born to take in this lifetime. And it's not defined in middle world cultural or social terms. Rather, it's defined in underworld terms, which are mythic, symbolic, metaphorical of the dream world, and archetypal or ecological. So in a sense, we're each born, everything, including we humans, we're born with a destiny to take a particular place or play a role in the natural, the more than human natural world itself. And to discover what that is, healthy cultures have initiatory processes. A particular kind of initiatory process that I call the soul initiation process, where it's not the soul that's being initiated, but the ego, the healthy ego, is being initiated into its original instructions, its relationships to its deeper underworld identity, its symbolic identity, that animus we've come to call our mythopoetic identity. It's because it's in terms of myth and symbol, as in poetry. So,
Bill, you just cut out for a second. I'm not sure if there's anything about your line that can be made more stable, but there was just a short loss of your transmission.
Right. Yeah, maybe someone else is trying to call me.
I see.
While waiting.
Okay.
So, the mythopoetic identity, what we call that is our soul, our identity on the soul level, on our place in the natural world. what we were born to do in this lifetime. And once we discover what that is through an initiatory process, which, by the way, we've pretty much lost. We've lost entirely in the mainstream Western world the underworld initiatory process. But once we do discover what our deeper soul-infused identity is, then we need to create a middle world cultural way of embodying that in the world. That becomes the next task. So just to summarize, we have these three worlds, upper, middle, and underworld, and they're not different places. They're not really necessarily different times of our life. They're more like different, we could say, different states of consciousness in which the underworld is the consciousness in which we're aware of this mythic dimension of our own lives, this the soul-oriented and in which we are, we experience our place in the natural world as ecological beings. And the middle world consciousness is when we're aware of their everyday life, and the upper world is when we're in relationship to a spirit or the one. So we can think of the, another way to think of the three worlds is that they're three identities. Every human has three fundamentally different identities. And one is middle world, which is social role, vocational role, the role we have in our neighborhoods or in our families. And the upper world identity, it's the same for everybody. It's our identity with the divine or the vast consciousness. And our underworld identities are very unique to us, but they're not on the personality level. They're on the soul level. So there's the background piece. And when it comes to these big questions about, for example, what's emerging today at the leading edge of human transformation, the way I think about it is, and this is just an analogy, actually, is that the human species is in the midst of an immense crisis, as I think just about everybody would agree. And because of our crisis, the entire planet is in crisis. And the crisis can be understood, that the planetary or the human, the global crisis can be understood as a phase in an initiatory process, similar to, or at least analogous to, the kind of initiatory process that individual humans go through. But we humans go through, in my understanding, at least 9 major initiations if we live well and live long enough. And this particular initiation I'm referring to, soul initiation, is the 4th of 9. And in this initiation, we need to die to everything we had understood about who we were and what the world was in our life. And in a healthy culture, this would happen in perhaps our mid-teen years. In a Jungian or depth psychology approach, it's considered it's something that, with good fortune, it happens in our early 40s, approximately midlife. And in mainstream Western culture, it virtually never happens. That's a little bit too strong to say it that way. Maybe my guesstimate is as maybe 10% of contemporary Western people ever have that experience, who are psychologically and spiritually ready for it. So so my sense of what is happening now on our planet is that we have this initiatory opportunity for our entire species in which we need to remember who we are, which requires to first lose our confidence, our belief in who we thought we were as really basically middle world people trying to make a living and get ahead and competing with others and saying that our religion or our nation is better and more important than others and so forth, begin to understand ourselves in a spiritual or transpersonal way in addition, both the upper world and the underworld sense. And there's no predicting what's going to happen. We can try to predict, but we don't really know. I love your title for this talk, Terry, Apocalypse versus Utopia, because it's really not either or. The bigger question is, for example, when we look at one of your questions, or our questions here, has humanity gone terribly wrong? I think it's the wrong question, essentially. It's my sense, and you and I have begun to talk about this, is that we, as a human species, the collective of humanity is facing this great crisis of identity and consciousness, and we might succeed at this initiatory passage that we've been in for, who knows, some would say 100 years or so, but I would say maybe it's 5 to 10,000 years we've been in an initiatory process, but we're at this crisis point where if we don't wake up soon enough as a collective, we don't know how many species are going to be left and how many habitable ecosystems will be left, on whether or not we ourselves might even have gone extinct along with the millions others of species that we are pushing off the edge of the cliff. And so this, again, this is analogous to the individual soul initiation process, in which in many cultures around the world that have had this process and still do, some of the initiates don't physically survive. It's that fierce of an initiation. And so we might say that we don't know at this point if humanity will survive. But if we do and undergo the initiatory process in a good way, we will understand ourselves and what it is to be participatory members of the Earth community and what our next steps in evolution might be. So there's at least a start to shake things up a little bit and some introduction.
Yeah. Well, I'm appreciating that you saved me all the work of asking all the individual questions that would have unpacked that background, and that we've started with, you know, a sort of solid basis of at least having an overview of the view of upper, middle, and lower world consciousness and your view of the current moment. I think that what I heard between the lines of what you just said that I'd like to kind of open up a little bit more is the idea that in some way perhaps this process has a kind of inevitability. Like maybe it's true that with an intelligent, self-aware species becoming so competitively advantaged, it and driven by procreative and consumptive urges, it might begin to devastate the natural world and create imbalances like we have and choke on its own wastes and overpopulate in everything that we see. But that still is a kind of horror, and I certainly feel this in my own body and psyche and being, the connectedness I feel to the natural world and seeing the disturbance of the normal weather patterns and the terrible stress that all the trees were under here recently when our drought became so extreme, for example. There is a kind of pain in that, and whether we draw from that a philosophy that, oh my God, everything has gone terribly wrong or not, we can't be indifferent to that. It's our own larger body. On the other hand, there may be a initiatory journey that might be more than we can take and might overwhelm and even extinguish us. On the other hand, there's a right way of being related to your initiatory journey, no matter what it is, and a kind of courage, a kind of willingness, a kind of a yes to what is happening, where the intensity of the challenge energizes and brings forward what's best in us rather than drawing us to a mode only of, I mean, not that grief is inappropriate, but only of, you know, the kind of depressive mode of grieving in which we're depleted and merely sorrowful and kind of, oh no, things have only gone terribly wrong. And that finding a kind of a yes, like somehow my soul chose to take birth in this time, in this place, under these circumstances, and my place in the natural order of things has something to do with showing up in the midst of this crisis moment with as much health consciousness and creative engagement as I possibly can. And this facing of this and kind of a naked, unarmored willingness to feel the intensity of everything that's going on has come, you know, at times I've become disoriented and depressed by it, and at other times just bewildered. I mean, it's worked me over tremendously through the course of my life. And at this moment in my process, I am feeling enlivened and awakened by it. It's not that I have an answer. It's a koan. It's a deeper question than I have an answer for, but it's stretching and changing me. And it seems that it might have in it the potential to draw me together with you, together with any other soul, conscious and awake in the mystery of existence, into something deeper that might be the beginnings of a healthy human response to this bewildering and amazing and exhilarating and crazy moment that we find ourselves in. And I know that you feel deeply, and that your connection to this, everything that you've elaborated and that you just summarized, you know, might reflect in a useful way on this koan.
Mm. Yeah, I hope so. Your grieving seems to be the doorway to a lot of, to many of the personal growth or development processes we can go through at almost any time or stage of life. That there's we protect, especially in the contemporary Western world, where we don't have grieving processes as regular parts of our cultural and community lives. It's often the case that it seems that what's waiting at the door of our hearts and bellies is grief, or some not fully assimilated experience of great loss. And we tend to, in the Western world, we tend to think when we're feeling sad or grieving that it's just all personal. And certainly we all have our personal losses in terms of relationships and family or health and or the particular bioregion, the health of the bioregion we live in. But there's also this there's all kinds of transpersonal griefs that come through us, and including griefs, losses of our ancestors that weren't fully digested or assimilated by them, and the losses that the Earth is experiencing, the degradation of our ecosystems and land, water, air. And so for so many people, the process of a major spurt in their personal development seems to be when they open up to whatever that grief is. We're not certain what it is. We just can feel it on the other side of the door. And we often try to keep a door shut. But once we open it, it turns out to be an extraordinary awakening experience where we become much more alive and in tune to what's happening. We don't have to read the news to know that the more than human world is, which includes the human world, is going through an immense disruption in just about every nameable level. And we can become more alive, we're more open, we're more sensitized, our bodies are no longer so protected from the emotions and the sensing of the miracle of life on this planet, and the danger to that life. And so that the grief leads to that kind of aliveness. If we really do our grieving, we become more alive. And the aliveness allows us, among other things, to be more authentic with each other, more real about our lives, and to understand what's going on in the world through the lens or the context of, you know, the jobs we have and the effects that the products or services that we are supporting, what effects they have in the world. And so we begin to change the way we live because of that, and maybe we'll become activists and helping others to wake up and help to save as much life on this planet as we can, while our industrial growth society is going about its business, which entails so much destruction of life. And so we end up going through a foundational experience that I call awakening, which Terry, you and I have had some laughs about that in the past, because what you mean by awakening, I think, is the upper world oriented awakening to the vast consciousness, which is certainly a way that the term has been often used, more commonly the way than I use it, which I mean awakening to our individual, visceral, experiential waking up to the fact that we are participatory members in an animate world of that's more than just human, and where we begin to experience ourselves as first and foremost fellow creatures on this planet. And once we go through that awakening, everything is different, and we experience our life and what it is to be alive, and how we can contribute to the world is a very different kind of thing. We're not just contributing to culture, we're contributing to the larger Earth community. And that, for me, I've come to understand that awakening, which I call ecological awakening or eco awakening, is foundational to, it's really like the entrance to the process of soul initiation, because that echo awakening, within a number of months or years, it will lead to our going through a major life passage, which is hardly ever spoken of at all in the Western traditions, including Western psychology, partly because relatively few people ever get to that point, that transition. I call it confirmation, and what's being confirmed, this is an experience after echo awakening, what's being confirmed is that we have created a personality, a social role or set of roles that is authentic enough, that's real, to who we experience ourselves as, and also socially acceptable enough. And getting those two together, social acceptance and authenticity, is challenging in the healthiest of societies. And in ours, it's a real, real difficult thing. Because the mainstream Western world puts all its eggs in the basket of social acceptance, that we all the advertising, the way our educational systems, most of them, and most of our religious systems are worked out, they're all ways to put pressure on us actually to conform, rather than find out who we really are, to become authentic. But once we become real in a social way and socially acceptable to our peer group, then it seems that the psyche or the mystery of the world moves us into this transition time that I call confirmation. And what's being confirmed is that we've created a personality that works well enough, we could just stay right there developmentally the rest of our life and keep accessorizing that personality, but we don't need to anymore. We've got a first way of belonging in the world, and it's time to leave that first house of belonging and go out into the world. As Mary Oliver says in her poem, The Journey, it's time to stride deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing we can do, determined to save the only life we can save. And the life she's referring to that is the only one that is worth saving is our soul's life, the life that is embodied by giving the one gift that we were born to give to this world. And so we leave, at confirmation, we leave our adolescent house of belonging, and the soul initiation process begins at that point. And in healthy traditional societies, at that time, the initiate is taken away from the village life, because the village life will just get in the way of the process. and are either taken to an initiatory camp somewhere for some number of months or longer, or are sent out on a solo journey, like a walkabout, or like what the Basque people do in the Pyrenees, a year of walking solo. And during the initiatory process, the initial goal is actually three phases. The first phase is dying to who we thought we were. And so you can see how being away from everyday social life is essential for that. And then when that severance or dying is complete, then is the second phase of experiencing the world in its magical, symbolic, mysterious qualities, and beginning to, with the hope of and the goal of seeing our place or our niche, our ecological role in the world through a visionary or revelatory experience, which is, again, it's symbolic, it's metaphorical, it's not like a job or a social role. And then the third phase is coming back and with bringing back as much of what we have gathered as we can, and then learning how to be that in our among our people in our communities. So I don't remember what your question was. But,
well, I appreciate what you've just been bringing forward and what I'm especially keying into as I feel this for myself and for the people who are with us right now is the invitation that's implicit in everything you're saying to each of our own soul journey, and for that to go much more deeply than tends to even seem possible given the vision of what a human being is and what a human life is that's constantly communicated and reinforced through our public sphere, the nervous system of our culture that communicates itself through, you know, the media, television and radio and newspapers and the internet, and the deeper knowing of our own wild nature we have to listen to something, to a deeper voice within ourselves to just begin to pull away from the magnetism of that more profane and superficial identity, and that invitation is what I feel most resonant with as I feel into what you're saying. And it's bringing to mind for me something that I discussed with someone who was on this program just a few months ago, Sarah Beek, who is very much focused on the soul's journey and who makes her own, it's not unheard of before her, but it's kind of an original emphasis that she brings forward, which really has to do with discovering her own soul as a profound presence, as an actual being with whom her ordinary awareness has a relationship and a love relationship and a developing sensitivity to the needs of that one and the kind of demands that one be true to a deeper level of oneself. And you don't specifically use that language about a relationship to that voice of the soul, but as you speak about becoming sensitive to that through your map, the implicit invitation suggests a kind of fidelity to a different voice that brings to mind what she was putting forward. And I wonder how that resonates for you.
Yeah, excuse me. It does resonate. I think as we go through that period of what I call ecological awakening, we become aware of the soul at that stage as kind of like a guardian angel, something like that, is a voice that is pointing us in the direction of our own personal development so that we'd be ready for the descent to soul at some point. So the way I think of it, in the first half of life, the soul is kind of like a something like a guardian angel. It's a voice we hear, especially at those transition times, those crisis / opportunity times of our lives. And when we're in great confusion and not sure what to do, we hear that small voice that's suggesting where to go and what to do. Like in my late 20s, I heard that voice partly through a dream, suggesting that where I should make my home is in the four corners of the United States, where the four states come together, mm-hmm. somewhere in that area. I actually had a dream with a map. And so people have those kind of experiences, or they might hear a voice that says suddenly in a crowded room that there's one particular individual in that room that you really got to get to know. And it's not necessarily someone that you've suddenly fallen in love with, although it could be, because falling in love is one of those trickster things, among other things, where the mystery gets us to fall in love with just a person who's just exactly the right one and exactly the wrong one. The wrong one in the sense that our entire life will be shook up by being in relationship to them. So I think soul works that way, and many people experience, especially in the first half of life, and the people experience like it's a relationship that can be developed. There's also, for people in the Western world, there's often a relationship that's developing with what I would call the muse, or some would call Jungians would call it the anima, or the animus, or the, sometimes I call it the guide to soul, or the inner wanderer. And this, to me, is not the same as the soul, but they're related in some way. And so we begin to have develop a relationship with the muse. Like I mentioned at the very beginning of this talk, that the muse woke me up, as it often does, at 3 a.m. and started dictating things to me. And that's where my writing comes from. I won't write until the muse suggests where I need to go. I don't think that's quite the same as the soul. The soul is even deeper and more mysterious and more dreamlike. But as we go through the soul initiation process, we have this one particular transition moment, which is just absolutely stunning and shocking to us. It's a great blessing, but it's also kind of a violation when we experience it. And it's when we recognize that the soul is not here primarily to guide us, that we suddenly realize that we have an obligation, a sacred responsibility to serve the soul. And at that point, the tables turn in our life. And it's, as I say, it's a time of great blessing and a sense of burden, that a sense that we're not going to spend the rest of our lives just being students of the world, including students of the soul, or philosophies or spiritualities. That at that point we recognize from a kind of a kick in the butt that comes from inside, that comes from the soul, that we have to actually go out into the world and embody what the soul wants us to live, and that the rest of our lives will be primarily being servants of the soul, as opposed to a being that's being guided by the soul, although there's that too. And so then, yes, there's a different kind of relationship of being in service. And that moment, when that reversal happens in the relationship with the soul, I call it the moment of soul initiation.
Mm.
And poetically, my favorite poetic rendition of that is from the contemporary British-American poet David White, who refers to the promise it will kill you to break. And this happens in the very depths of the soul initiatory journey, or towards the penultimate moment, where we recognize that there's as David says, there's a truth at the center of the image we were born with. And through the revelatory experience, we recognize finally what that truth is. And we realize that we have an obligation to go into the world with that truth on our lips and to live that truth with how we embody our lives. So again, that's the moment of soul initiation, which is at the very end of the process of soul initiation. And that's where that relationship changes with the soul. We see our lives as servants of the mystery of the soul.
You know, Bill, I want to offer, because I've become a public teacher of matters, spiritual and soul related only after working closely with Ken Wilber, who's known so much as a map maker and a builder of overviews of things. And you as a person who's created powerful maps, many of which you're speaking from right now, which are really different from those maps, there's a kind of coming together of the integral and the eco-psychological in us being in conversation. And I'm not interested to debate the different maps. I feel like that's not I'm very much, I'm more interested in learning from you and in opening to what you have to offer than in deflecting anything. But I think it might be helpful to unpack something that comes up for me, where I, as you describe this process of soul initiation, it feels like I can locate moments in my process in which things just really radically shifted, and in which the orientation to my ordinary life shifted to an orientation to a spirituality that was transcendent and, upper world in your model, and how I then had another initiation which dropped me into my relationship to, the body, the earth, and soul especially, and a listening, a deeper kind of listening, very much slower pace, a deeper octave that arrived me in a accountability of a different kind. But for me, the maps I know that put soul at a lesser degree of ultimacy or whatever than higher non-dual awakenings, and then the maps that put those at an earlier stage, your maps kind of place that at at the east in an earlier part of the cycle to the soul initiation and the deepening that winds around the circle you draw. I find myself actually arriving in a place of, I'm so grateful to my soul for having opened me as it did to that upper world practice and realization. And I continue to be a humble student of the fullness of that radical awakening, which can become more consistent and pervasive, and which does continue to deepen. And I find myself feeling that at certain times in my life, it has been necessary, and it has been recently necessary for me to focus on soul work, not spirit work, and as much. But and therefore that there are phases in one's life that can be 6 months to a year to 2.5 years, where a particular type of revelation is taking place, a particular type of initiation and deepening and awakening or whatever it is forward, but that then there's room for something else to happen. And I find myself remembering the maps not being the territory and the territory being wild and surprising. And I find myself feeling very still and very interested to listen only at deeper and deeper levels and to trust more profoundly. And that free clarity of awakeness, awareness as being itself, and the deepening into my very toes and into contact with this living earth and these creatures and the unique calling of my deeper nature through this particular expression that I was called to make in this world and that I am still being called to more fully embody, that that I need to appreciate everything that I notice through studying either or any of so many different maps, and then arrive without the map in front of my face, but only sort of still and open in the territory itself. And the battle, which is more important or which is more primary, you know, like each can seem like a tyranny that excludes the other, and I never want to see either excluded, but I become somehow more full when I'm holding my maps very lightly. I wonder how that feels to hear that and what you might want to say in response.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I agree. it's always great to remind ourselves, both as map makers and map users, that the map is not the territory. Maps or models can give us conscious access to realms of experience that we might not have recognized or found the doors to without those maps. So maps and models are just tremendous value. Certainly have been to me, and I'm hearing you say the same. But yes, they limit us at the same time, that we tend to try to get everything to fit somewhere in our map. And if we're being open enough to experience, then we will come along to an event, an experience at some point that just doesn't fit well, honestly, easily in our map. And often the map has to disintegrate. We have to go back to the drawing board. And that's, I think, part of what it is to evolve as a human being, as we go from one map to the next. And so for me, I was trained as a psychologist, and so I was studying the maps of famous psychologists, and none of them quite did it for me. There were some experiences I had that I couldn't easily fit on there without, you know, a crowbar, stuffing it in the wrong place, or something round in a square hole. And then the spiritualities, I was disciplined to, or apprenticed to, in my late teens, early 20s, and so on. There was something seemed to be missing. I was a student. I like to say that my first spiritual discipline was being overwhelmed by romantic feelings towards women. As a heterosexual male, that was quite a spiritual experience for me. And I think for many of us, of course, romance is a spiritual discipline. So, but in terms of the way we usually talk about spiritualities, my first spirituality that spoke to me at all, because the religion of my family did not, was my first year in college at Duke University, 1968. I went to the Zendo. I learned Zen meditation, and that experientially made a huge difference in my life. And soon after that, I also became a student of yoga, Kundalini yoga in particular, which is well known for creating some very intense, non-ordinary states. And around that time, I also became a student of hallucinogens, entheogens, and which led to my experience in the world as a very, very, very different place than I had thought it was. And I think my early some of my early upper world experiences were were the gifts of experiences with psychedelics, where I experienced my own consciousness as one with this larger consciousness. And so that changed things quite a bit. And because of these kinds of experiences and others, I would look at the maps of the spiritual disciplines I had been exposed to and studied, and also to the maps of psychologists, and saying, boy, there's this huge realm that's missing, that some seem to leave out the body and or the emotions or the deep imagination, and most all of them, except depth psychology, seem to leave out the soul in a real way. And so I started putting together maps that worked for me, and it was mostly just to help myself get oriented, and then I would start to share that with people I was guiding on programs. And really, most of what I learned in the last 33 years of being a guide is by guiding and the experiences of the people I was guiding and my own experiences going through the same kind of processes. And that helped me develop these maps and models. So in other words, the maps for me did not primarily come from reading other people's maps, although that was a major piece of input too. But that wasn't the primary input. It was mostly from just having the experience of going through these practices, soul-oriented practices myself, and designing practices and programs, immersions for others, and offering my attention the best I could to what was happening. And along the way, I discovered that my maps were just not adequate. There were just these other experiences that I or others were having that didn't fit, and so we had to go back to the drawing board. And finally, got to the place about 10 years ago where I thought I could start writing these down and publishing them. And at some point, I'll probably have to retract major aspects. Who knows? But one other thing you said, I had another association to it, and that is. My own experience is the following. I think it's true for many others that in some ways it's more likely to have upper world experiences before we have underworld experiences. I'm not saying that the underworld experiences are more important or come at a later stage of life necessarily, but for us Westerners, I think it's often the case that they do. And the way I think about that is that part of what I'm about to say comes from the developmental wheel that I've been developing along with my colleagues at Animus Fly Institute, that I've mapped the what I call the soul-centric or echocentric stages of human development, 8 stages on the cardinal directions, starting in the east and going clockwise, which is sunwise, around to the south and the west and north and back to the east. It's really a spiral, because when we come back to the east, it's not the same place we started. And the east is the direction that is most associated with spirit. It's not the same, but it's a spirit, but it's associated with it. And so in some ways, if we are born in the east, and in a certain sense, that we start we are born from the one, from the mystery, from the great mystery. And whereas soul is more associated with the West, and we don't get to the full West place until halfway through life. And so a person in the stages, the 2 stages of childhood or the 2 stages of adolescence can have upper world experiences are really open to people of any stage, that experience of oneness. In some ways, we might say children in the first 3 years are living in an upper world experience. They are not fully differentiated yet from the one, from the mystery. And in fact, the goal of the first stage, the first 4 years of life, is that differentiation so that the child becomes conscious of herself as a separate being. And that's something that's unique to beings with conscious self-awareness like humans. When I was a 5-year-old, I have memories of sitting in the back of my parents' car driving somewhere, and it's a rainy day. I grew up in Boston. There was a lot of rainy days, And I have memories of experiences of dissolving my consciousness, dissolving into the raindrops on the window, and I was the rain. And years later, I recognized that as a kind of, in a certain sense, a very early kind of upper world experience. And many people through spiritual disciplines of a variety, of great variety, or through entheogens have had these experiences of oneness. In some ways, when these upper world experiences happen in our adolescence, which I don't mean our teen years, I mean a psychological state that might go through our, you know, our 90s or if we live that long. But in our psychological adolescence, these upper world experiences actually can help us be ready for the descent to soul, because we have the experience that I am not simply my social identity. That this consciousness is a much wilder, mysterious thing than that. And this loosens our attachment to our identity. The upper world experiences can loosen our attachment to our social identity. And that, when we're prepared on other dimensions as well, psychologically, that can, you might say, open the trap door to the descent. Mm. I hope that made a little, at least a little bit of sense.
Yeah, no, that makes great sense, Bill. And there's a... I feel an obligation because I have many people who will be listening to this who are very aware of aspects of the, you know, spiritual traditions that point out that there's a different kind of oneness in infancy than there is in the Buddha, that there's a pre and a post transcendence, and they're not the same, and who would also look at the, you know, incredibly rich description of soul practice, including the kind of shamanic vision quest aspects of the Tibetan tradition, but that do have a progression in which the ultimate realizations are that of a non-duality in which radical awareness coincides with, you know, is not different from the arising. And so there's Well, I don't want to get into this too much because it can go back and forth. You know, my sense is, though, that there are profundities upon profundities in both immanent and transcendent expressions that, for me, are in an eternal dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I only feel sympathy and resonance with what you express, except to the degree that it seems that dialogue becomes, you know, the hands ascending up the baseball bat and trying to kind of hold the top of the bat. And I want not to be marginalizing anything. And it seems important that that be voiced without taking anything away from the profound resonance of the invitation that I hope people are feeling in the words you're speaking.
Yeah, thanks. It really resonates what you're saying with my experience too, that I believe when we have upper world experiences of oneness, it's actually different. It's not only two versions. It's different in every stage of life. When an adolescent has a oneness experience, it's different than as a child. And after soul initiation, at the beginning of what I call true adulthood, an upper world experience is different yet than it was before initiation. And through the stages of adulthood and elderhood, I believe the upper world experience grows and develops. So in some ways, I'd say there's at least 8 categories of upper world experiences, and it really does grow and develop and deepen.
Mm. Well, Bill, this is such a rich conversation. I just kind of want to keep talking back and forth with you, but I want to make room for others to ask questions, and I do have some important announcements. So if you have a question you'd like to ask to Bill or to me, please, if you're listening by phone, you can raise your hand by pressing *2 on your telephone keypad, *2. Or if you're listening on your computer, there is a little window where you can type in a question, and you're invited to do so. First, I want to make sure that you know how to find out more about Bill and his work. This July, the 9th through the 13th, Bill is going to be guiding a Wild Mind Intensive, a 5-day experiential soulcraft immersion at a ranch in the high mountain wilderness of northern New Mexico. He's been refining this work for 3 decades, and he's built a team of experienced guides who accompany people into the inner and outer wilderness. And he and his colleagues at Animas Valley Institute offer more than 40 other experiential immersions every year in a variety of locations in North America and Europe, ranging from 4 days to 14 in length, including contemporary vision fast ceremonies. And you can learn more about these immersions and about Animas Valley Institute and about Bill's books at animas.org. Animas.org. Now, I know your approach to these wilderness events is unique in some ways, and maybe there's something more you want to say about that.
Well, there's just generally there's two categories of things we do. The first, or three categories. The first two are foundational to the soul work, and the first two we call healing and self-wholing. And that's, in general, those two are what we mean by the wild mind work. We're primarily helping people cultivate the four facets of their innate human wholeness, which our Western contemporary society and institutions don't do a very good job at. In fact, they might suppress our human wholeness. So we, in our work, we do lots of work helping people cultivate all four of these facets, and two in particular are actually suppressed by contemporary Western world. So we really focus on those, which one has to do with the deep imagination and the muse, and the other with our body and our emotions and our kinship with all the other beings. And then the healing work is really what we call self-healing. That's S with a capital S, myself with a capital S, which is similar to Jung's sense of the self. And from the place of consciousness where we cultivated the four facets, we can heal ourselves in ways that are really quite profound and maybe deeper than we can when we're being more passive patients of healers. And then the other category of the work we do is nature-based soul initiation work, which is what I've been talking about. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for elaborating that. So if you're interested to just learn more about that or get on Bill's mailing list, you can go to animas.org. Additionally, I want you to be aware of my work. And even if you have gotten onto the mailing list for this series, Beyond Awakening, you're not necessarily on my personal mailing list, which you'd find at Terry Patten, my name, TerryPatten.com. And there you can be in touch with the leading edge of my teaching and evolution. So I invite you to go there and get on my mailing list and read my blog and find out more about the upcoming events I'm doing and working with me individually. And pretty soon I'm going to be offering a 4-day experiential exploration in Freiburg, Germany, May 1st through 4th. It's called The Revelation of the Soul, an experiential exploration. And we're going to come together at the intersection of soul work and integral evolutionary practice, entering into higher intersubjectivity, the soul of the we, and also social activism in our time of global crisis. It'll be organized around experiential processes that focus on deepening into presence and encountering your soul, learning to trust enough to hear the voice of your soul, soul-connected relating to others, and exploring what is asked of us, each of us and all of us together, to become the ones we've been waiting for in this time of global crisis. I'll be giving some evening talks on listening to the soul of the new we in Zurich, Switzerland, on April 30th, and in Copenhagen on May 6th. And then I'll be speaking and teaching at what promises to be a historic event. The first Integral European Conference will be taking place in Budapest, May 8th through 11th. You're invited to go there, too. And when I get back, I'll be leading a major event in Boulder, Colorado, at the end of May, May 23rd through 26th, called the Integral Living Room. And there I'll be working with Ken Wilber, Diane Hamilton, and Jeff Salzman. The Integral Living Room is kind of a different kind of a cauldron. It's a profound exploration of the practice of higher order hanging out for the what we call the best conversations of your life. So you can find out about all these things at terrypatton.com. And, you know, if you enter your email address, I'll keep you informed in the future. So let's look at the questions that have arrived. And the first one, a really wonderful question, is from a mutual friend of ours, Bill, Reggie Mara. And Reggie asks, how does one know if he or she has found soul purpose? How does one really know? What exactly does unique mythopoetic place in the web of life actually mean, feel, look like day to day?
Yeah, thanks, Reggie. A great question. I'm laughing here a little bit to myself because that's a question that comes up a lot. And in my book, Soulcraft, I offer 12 criteria, or parameters, or aspects of soul encounter experiences. Soul encounter, by soul encounter, I mean moments when we have a glimpse of our mythopoetic identity, whereas soul initiation is the larger process. And so I'm laughing because I've started carrying around with me a list of those 12, and I'm looking for them right now. But we'll see how many I can remember offhand. One thing, okay, so we know it's a soul encounter experience, an experience of the deeper soul purpose of our life. If it's not in cultural terms, it's not in vocational terms, not in terms of a particular craft, like in my case, being a psychologist or an author or a vision fast guide or a soul craft guide, those are all social roles. When the soul speaks, as I was mentioning before, it speaks in mythopoetic terms, something that's really mysterious. And when we have that glimpse, when we have that experience, we feel it's a second quality of soul encounters. We feel it's both a blessing and a burden. We feel like this is a sacred revelation. This is what my life is really all about, to manifest this. But on the other hand, there is no way I could do it. There's a who, me? It would be impossible. It's way too big. And not only that, it's way too mysterious. I wouldn't even know how to begin. So there's that dual aspect. And I probably should give some examples. The easiest example for me to give is my own first soul encounter. I've had a few, but the first one was on my own first vision fast in 1980, on the fourth day of my fast. I won't tell the long version of it, but the very short version is that I saw a butterfly come by. I was up at tree line at 11,000 feet in northern Colorado at the edge of a lake, and a butterfly came by and brushed my face on the left side, and I heard the words as it did that, cocoon weaver. And I had no idea what it meant, but after a few seconds, I realized that this was a numinous experience, and I recognized it was very emotional, and that I had some primary relationship with the image of weaving cocoons, and it took some number of months to even begin to get a sense of what that was about. But I'd say in hindsight, that's one thing I've been doing the last 33 years. So it's an experience of something like that. And often, I think more often than not, the experience is in terms of nature images, like the weaving of cocoons. Or I love to use the example of the great Irish poet William Butler Yeats, Huna poem called The Song of Wandering Angus, which he wrote in his late 20s and during his first Saturn return, for you astrologers out there. And by the way, my first Vision Fest was also during my Saturn return. This is a very common pattern. Yeats wrote at the end of that poem essentially that he would spend the rest of his days plucking the silver apples of the moon and the golden apples of the sun. So again, we have metaphor, nature, images, and when we look back at his 80 or so years of life, we can say that's really what he was doing. He was plucking those apples, which for him, the moon, sun and the moon had everything to do with the really deep symbols of the masculine and the feminine. So that's a third experience. And by the way, not everyone, when they have a soul encounter, has an experience like during a fast or out in the natural world. Others simply have a revelation at some point when they're ready that they see the pattern that their life has been making on a deep level, and they recognize it again as something numinous, as both a blessing and a burden, and something that changes everything about their life. Like, for example, my partner, Janine Haugen, both my life partner and work partner, she recognized at some point, and she has a few versions of it, but one is that her soul gift to the world had to do with generating perception, expanding images. And that's really, they just come through her, and they tend to shake up people's worldviews. And so those are a few of the criteria. Others are things like they tend to happen during non-ordinary states of consciousness. Another criteria is we recognize we have an obligation to it, to live that truth. Or we recognize that we need to promise, make a deep private vow that we will our life will be about embodying that. So, and if I can't find that list right here, but there's about, if you look in Soulcraft, you find the book Soulcraft, you find a list of about 8 other criteria of, they're not criteria, sorry, they're just common qualities of the experience of soul encounter that allow us to recognize if it was actually the real thing.
Thank you. Well, I want to take a live call now. The first person to raise, his or her hand, is a name that shows up as Maura Collins. And you're live with us. Hello. Please introduce yourself.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. My name is Lauren Kiley, and I would like to thank Bill, because listening to your life experience helps me to see my life in a whole much clearer perspective. I've been developing a somatic self-regulation practice based on Stephen Porges' understanding of the social engagement system. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that work?
No, sorry, I'm not.
Yeah, he identified a third branch of intelligence in the mammalian autonomic nervous system called the social engagement system, mm-hmm. unique to the mammal. And it's 5 cranial nerves that work together to present us with
disciplined to make sure that our callers are asking questions rather than offering a different teaching.
Yeah, okay. So what I want to say is that in the mythopoetic, would you relate that to the imaginal realm and also to the primordial realm?
Yeah, interesting question. I certainly relate it to the imaginal. It seems that, there's so many things to say about that. One is depth psychologists, I'm thinking of James Hillman now in particular, who reminds us, who says that the psyche at its base, at its root, at its essence, is of image. That when we encounter the soul, it's an encounter with the deep imagination. And it's the deep imagination, the sort that shows up in dreams, for example, or in revelation or visions. It's the deep imagination that of the what my colleague Steve Gallegos refers to as the four windows of knowing. It's the deep imagination that is most suppressed in the contemporary Western world by our educational religious systems, because it's most dangerous to the contemporary Western world. It's the doorway to the mythopoetic is the deep imagination. So a lot of the work and practices we do at Anima Style Institute is helping people open that window and to practice experiencing, knowing the world through that window of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Another thing I learned from my partner Janine Haugen is she has this visionary sense that that we humans are going through an evolutionary shift now. Many people, of course, have that experience, but her take in particular is that we're becoming more and more what she would call homo imaginans. I love that phrase, homo imaginans, which she coined herself. And that is humans who are growing into a capacity to be in full embrace of the magic and mystery and potency of our own imagination. And the particular thing that about our human imagination is that we can imagine the future. And we don't know if other species, those without conscious self-awareness, can do that. That's something we can do, and it's maybe a big part of our evolutionary potential. And then the other question you asked, Lauren, was about the primordial, and I have to admit I'm not sure what you mean by that, so I can't really address that one.
Well, primordial is kind of what's with us since the beginning. So, yeah, I mean, I would say it would. But there's more that I'll connect with you on your personal website, because I don't want to take up more time. I have more things I want to say to you. But thank you for taking my question.
Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah, thanks very much, Lauren.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Yeah. Okay, there are a lot of people who've typed in questions on the really good questions. I wonder if we could go a few minutes late, Bill. We're getting close to the 11:30 mark, but I'd like to ask at least a couple more.
Sure.
There's a cluster of questions. I'd like to read a couple that seem to really focus on mood, on how we feel hope and action, and you know how we feel and how that relates to action. Let me read three of them. JD in Salida, Colorado asks, how do we cultivate a sense of hope in light of the immense destruction that's becoming increasingly apparent? How does this grieving process lead us through the dark passage back to the middle world? And how can we can incorporate the gifts we bring back from the journey? And then Mike in Edmonton asks, in Wild Mind, you write about joy being something that you continue to work within yourself. Can you speak about that in relation to this soul initiation and mythopoetic process? And
could I hear that one again?
Yeah, about joy.
Yeah. Okay.
In relation to the soul initiation mythopoetic process. And then there's a question from Robert in Sandia Park. Any thoughts about the futility of civil disobedience in the midst of this? So, you know, I can feel people really kind of processing this at a fairly deep level and mm-hmm. asking about their own felt experience implicit in that cluster of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, I'm going to make an attempt here at these three questions. I think I heard the first one is how to cultivate hope.
Mm-hmm.
And the best thing I could do shorthand would be refer people to Joanna Macy's new book with Chris Johnstone called Active Hope. And probably most of the listeners know Joanna Macy's work, one of our great Earth elders now. And she began her career many decades ago doing what I think, if I got the phrase right, despair and empowerment work. And she recognized that she was working with activists, environmental activists, nuclear activists, and so on, and that people were pretty much stuck unless they just totally opened up to their grief and even their despair. And she created ceremonies and practices for people to do that. And what she found is that when people could get together and just really be honest emotionally and to do their grief work, they came out empowered, ready to take action. And I think that's very true. And her new book, Active Hope, is just elaborates on that in all kinds of ways. And the idea here, we're hearing this from many other people, like Rebecca Solnit has written about this, and Vaclav Havel, that hope is a thing with legs, I think Rebecca says. And it's about that Joanna's way of saying that is active hope. Hope is not something that, just a belief that if we sit back, there will be others out there who will take care of things, or the earth will take care of it by itself, or and so on. That when we experience true, deep, genuine hope, it's something that gets us rolling, gets us out there and making a difference. Whether we've had the soul initiation experience yet or not, either way. So, yeah, that's, I think, a big piece of it. And the second question from Mike, who might be a Mike that I know from Edmonton, is about joy in relationship, the process of soul initiation. And if it is the Mike I know, then he knows that that's been a big issue in my personal process of, you know, a lot of us are, this is definitely true for me, a lot of us are afraid to fully feel our grief. It's a very overpowering, overwhelming emotion, and there's so much of it waiting for us. But for some of us, like me, joy is also, can be terrifying to really open up just fully to the bliss of being alive at this on this magical planet, and also to be alive at this time of great change when we have the privilege of contributing. yeah, I believe when we encounter our souls, when we encounter that our destiny, the truth at the center of the image we were born with, or again, as David White says, the truth we make every day with our own bodies and usually aren't aware of it. When we encounter that truth, there's a great bliss to that, a term that Joseph Campbell used. And there's a great joy with that. And part of my process has been recognizing, wish I could tell you the longer story, but we don't have time. But I had an experience many years ago that... of death, the personification of death, which I met in an alcove in the desert one day, that a death, in this vision, I experienced death as actually being married. And his wife, he introduced me to his wife and said her name was Joy. So, and to understand how joy and death are in a dance with one another, and that death is a part of the experience of life here on this planet and probably anywhere, which makes possible joy. I wish I could say more about that, but that's a brief piece of it. And when we go through the soul initiation experience, we're going through a type of dying experience. It doesn't sound so good as we're heading down the chute, but on the other side of it, there's a kind of joy that's just indescribable.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's see... thanks. Robert asked about the is civil disobedience futile?
Yeah.
Good question. I'm definitely not no expert on that. I've asked some of my elders about that. For example, Joanna Macy, and who is an activist as well as a scholar of Buddhism and systems theory and ecology. And Joanna talks about, of course, the great turning, which is the opportunity we have now of making the great turn from a an ecocidal and suicidal industrial growth society to a life-sustaining or even life-enhancing society. That's the big opportunity we have on the planet now. And she talks about three dimensions of the work of the Great Turning. And the first one is saving as much life as possible. And briefly, the second one has to do with creating the infrastructure, social and energy and so forth, infrastructure for a new, healthy, sustainable, deeply imaginative culture. And the third one has to do with shifting values and consciousness, which is more of the in the realm of what our work is at Animus. But back to the first dimension of saving as much life as possible. I did ask Joanna once, I said, is there ever any grounds for any kind of violence at all? Which I guess civil disobedience a kind of version of that in saving life. And she said, yes, there can be under certain circumstances that we wouldn't want to save life ourselves. But one of the greatest gifts we can give to the world now is to save as many of species and habitats as we can while the industrial growth society completes this process of collapse that it's well into at this point.
Thank you, Bill. You know, there are a couple of people who type in messages that I want to quickly respond to. One of them is someone who very poignantly and beautifully just expressed his or her feeling of aloneness, this diaspora of a far-flung soul community. And I do want to say that this listening to that still small voice of the soul, and if you're feeling and experiencing these kinds of things, so you're resonating with what Bill is saying and some of the things that I've said too, this is a sign of your own deepening. And sometimes that feels like grief and it feels like profound aloneness, but you're actually, it's part of a gateway to a connectedness that's even more profound, and you're not as alone as you tend to feel. And it feels important that that be said in the midst of this conversation. If you'd like to elaborate on that, Bill, you're certainly welcome to.
Yeah, just briefly, I think aloneness, a couple of angles on that. One is that it might be the way we explain to ourselves sadness or grief that's coming up, that if we go into it, if we are ready to dive into it, we might find it's all kinds of other losses as well. And a second thing to say is, finding the others who have awakened, gone through what I call ecological awakening, is somewhere between beneficial and necessary. And the other one is, I'm thinking of what many teachers have said, including Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, the great German poet, who was a great proponent of the importance of solitude and all that solitude can teach us and all that it brings up, the fear and the grief and so on, that we can't get away from if we do have time in solitude. And it certainly was one of the greatest teachers for me, was to have lots of time alone, especially when I was younger, which came relatively easy for me because I'm a very shy and introverted person and needed lots of alone time to process things. But some of the greatest things I've learned was through extended times, many days at a time of being alone. And the Vision Fast, of course, is one version of that, is being alone for 4 days or so. And a great gift. So aloneness, in that sense, solitude can be a great gift and also can be, a stimulus for our great grief work that we need to do.
Well, thank you. You know, we're probably going to have to finish up now. There are other questions. I do want to respond to one question. Yes, there will be a recording of this conversation available soon. It'll be posted. You'll get another email within a few days with a blog post about the dialogue that'll include a link to the recording. And a couple of reminders, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. To learn more about Bill and all the work he's doing, go to animas.org, A-N-I-M-A-S, and you're invited to go to terrypatton.com to find out more about my work. Thank you so much for joining Bill and me today. And Bill, thank you very much. This has been rich. I feel almost like we've just begun, and now we need to go for another 90 minutes to go all the places that seem to have been called into the space.
Yeah, thank you, Terry. Really appreciate the invitation, and just love being in dialogue with you. It's a great opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Well,